Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Philanthropy has always played a role in American society, from supporting the arts to education, religious organizations, and various nonprofits. And within the philanthropy community, women have played a sometimes unheralded role. A local organization is working today to shine a light on the role women philanthropists played in earning voting rights for women in this country.
Joan Marie Johnson is a historian and author of the new book Funding Feminism: Moneyed Women, Philanthropy, and the Women's Movement. Johnson says without the large gifts made by wealthy women of society, progress in areas such as voting rights, education, and birth control would have been far slower.
The Women's Fund of Greater Milwaukee will honor past and present philanthropists at an event on Thursday. Ahead of that event, Johnson joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and the Women's Fund's Lisa Antonito by phone. She begins by explaining what drew her to this area of history.
There are many, many benefits, and philanthropy plays an enormously important role in our society. But we also, at times, see a little bit of hesitation, a little bit of nervousness that someone with money can perhaps have an outsized effect in making change in society. And I think looking back to some of these women in the women's movement were maybe more attractive to the activists themselves and not wanting to kind of follow that money trail and see the power that some of the wealthy women in this movement had. So I think that's why we really haven't looked at it all that much previously. There's been, you know, some studies here and there, but nobody's really pulled it all together. And the other reason, or another reason that we haven't really looked at it all that much, is that suffragists like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony really very specifically wanted a certain story about the history of the women's suffrage movement told. And they very carefully curated what documents would be available and put out a multi-volume set of histories about the movement contemporaneously. And that has really shaped how we've studied the movement up until recently. And recently, a lot of historians have begun to really kind of take that history apart and to widen it and widen our understanding of the movement.
With these women gaining power and influence when it comes to the suffragette movement, this follows an interesting shift, because traditionally women in charity were involved with their local churches. It was a lot of face time. It was volunteering their time and efforts rather than necessarily their money. So can you explain how foundations started to emerge and large gift philanthropy also emerged post-Civil War that allowed these women to give their money as a means of influence through nonprofit work?
Sure. There was really very significant shift in philanthropy in the late 19th century, and partly it had to do with the enormous fortunes that people like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller were making as these industrialists in the Gilded Age. And at the same time, this is referred to as the Progressive Era, and those reformers really wanted to be much more scientific and efficient and organized and professional about the kind of social reform they were doing. So they began first what they called the organized charity movement, just to really ensure that even that face-to-face charity of giving food or fuel or whatever the donations were to meet social service needs were more organized, that all the organizations could together efficiently serve one family. And from there, it really grew into a sense of, now that we're being efficient and organized about this, how can we actually get more at the roots of what's causing poverty, what's causing disease? And so you have Rockefeller and Carnegie setting up these enormous foundations that were doing what they called scientific philanthropy, in which they were trying to get at those root causes, and they were willing to fund research. At the same time, this was really also the rise in women's activism and the women's movement. We had seen the first women's rights convention in the world in Seneca Falls, New York in 1848. And after that, women really organizing, as you said, in churches and other kinds of local groups. And I think they kind of feed off this new scientific philanthropy with the goal of really fundamentally changing women's position in society. So again, getting at some of those root causes. And many of them really believed that if they could gain more political rights, that that would then elevate women's status in society and allow them to also make gains in economic empowerment and employment opportunities, as well as reproductive rights, so that it would really be a fundamental advancement for women in society.
With the common line of that fundamental advancement, where was the development of what the word feminism or feminist meant at this point in history? And what ranges of personal reasons did these moneyed women use to motivate their giving?
Well, feminism was really just beginning to be used, but really was not widely used at all in this time period. So I don't think any of the women in my book would have actually called themselves feminists. But they do certainly talk about, very passionately, about women's equality and women's place in society and the lack of opportunities and access that women had. And many of them, despite their privilege, were really motivated by their own experiences of gender discrimination, which is what we see today as well with major donors to women's causes.
Right, because even though women had the money via either inheritance or marriage, that didn't necessarily mean they had influence, that if they were a wealthy woman of society, it didn't mean they had the power necessarily.
Exactly. And so they still had abusive spouses, and they still had a difficult time accessing education. They sometimes had difficulty accessing that money if their husbands controlled it, or sometimes their fathers or their brothers controlled it. And I think it was even more important because they saw the kind of power that money could have in the lives of their fathers and their husbands and their brothers, and yet they didn't have access to that. So that motivated them to really think about women's place in society and to try to see themselves as part of a larger movement for women more generally.
One important point you make in the book is that women who are part of the elite society, perhaps they were giving to organizations such as art or music or the church or other things that weren't specifically for the advancement of women. So outside of the suffrage movement, which really stemmed women's involvement with philanthropy and financial giving, what other social changes would not have happened had moneyed women not stepped up? Because your book spans from the start of the suffragette movement all the way through 1967.
Right. So one of the most fundamental issues was really reproductive rights for what was then called the birth control movement. And then many of those women who were suffragists were supporting the right to birth control. And Catherine Dexter McCormick is the philanthropist who was a suffragist. She supported access to higher education for women, and she had been supporting the birth control movement all the way from the 19-teens through the 1960s. And after she inherited quite a bit of money, about $35 million, when her husband died in the late 1940s, she decided that it was really time, again, to make fundamental change for women when it came to reproductive rights and to support the research that would create a new form of birth control that would really change women's access and effectiveness for birth control. And so she single-handedly was supporting the scientists and the gynecologists who developed the pill. She literally was paying their salaries. She paid for their labs. She was paying for the rabbits they were experimenting on, and spent well over $1 million throughout the 1950s until the pill was developed and approved by the FDA in 1960.
Obviously, money can advance great things like the birth control pill, as you just mentioned, but there are some downsides of women's financial contributions through the movement. So you mentioned there is such a thing as coercive power of philanthropy. And since foundations were just beginning to start, you know, there wasn't necessarily that protective wall between money coming in and the goal and strategies of the work that those nonprofits are doing. So how did these women and their money possibly change the priorities, strategies, and success of the women's movement?
So that's a great question. And I think very directly, these women often made their contributions. Well, I wouldn't say often, but sometimes made contributions with requirements that headquarters be located in a certain place, or that a certain individual be officer in an organization, or that magazine take a certain kind of editorial tone. And there was a lot of resentment. There was a lot of resentment by other women in the movement. And I think it was one thing when a wealthy woman could use her money to kind of maybe convince male administrators at a university to open their doors to women. But it was another thing when a woman within a woman's organization was using her money to advance her own agenda. So it did cause a lot of resentment. And it also caused problems as well when, despite the fact that these women were motivated by their own experiences of gender discrimination to kind of try to see themselves as part of a larger sisterhood, they didn't always get past class differences, and certainly many parts of the women's movement were not open when it came to race. There was a lot of racism within the movement, and that kind of visionary thinking that they had when it came to advancing equity for women, they certainly didn't always extend across race or other kinds of identities.
Now looking ahead, as we're celebrating almost the 100th anniversary of the right to vote, you know, some of the things have stemmed out and changed, and women in philanthropy and the movement have spanned so far. So Lisa, to bring you into this, why is the Women's Fund this year honoring the power of philanthropy? And what do you hope people will learn about this history?
Well, of course, I want to start with just saying that the Women's Fund of Greater Milwaukee is focused on advancing equity for women. So you heard Joan say that in several phrases. So you can see there's a direct correlation to Joan's research and historical discoveries to what the Women's Fund is really focused on here in Milwaukee. Also, the things that Joan talked about as it relates to the core issues and systemic change, really trying to affect an attitude or behavior in order for the culture to change, is at the core of what the Women's Fund work has been since the beginning in 1985. And so we felt as a fund that this that Joan is a perfect person to highlight the value of philanthropy, but also the power of philanthropy, so that attendees and audience listeners think about what power they do have as philanthropists. And if they are an emerging philanthropist making $20 or $30 or $50 donations, how they can leverage those gifts with others to impact and make change for the betterment of all citizens.
And you are highlighting some people at this event, from emerging to established philanthropists. What are some key examples of the women who are being highlighted here?
Yes, this has become a tradition of the Women's Fund annual educational event. It started in 2016, and we've continued it each year, allowing our event sponsors to name somebody in the theme of the event itself. And so this year, our event sponsors did name a philanthropist, and we have an amazing collection of community people who have really worked hard to be generous and influence others to join them in a particular project or issue. My favorite, of course, is Joan Robertson. She's my favorite because she's the second woman I've met that's been over 100 years old. She was born in 1916, just before the 19th Amendment was ratified. And so I think her legacy as a philanthropist in the community is by far the most interesting to me. That does not diminish the contributions made by others. You know, they really run the gamut to people who are just starting their philanthropic work, people who are doing work locally and internationally. It's just amazing what these women have done, and maybe others will be inspired to join and emulate them.
Exactly. So this question is for the both of you, Lisa and Joan. You know, the women who have worked in the suffrage movement through, you know, the movements highlighted in your book, Joan, through 1967, you know, they did so because they thought it would bring true equality for women. Obviously, we still do not have that today. There's still unequal pay. There's still legislation that limits the power of women. So what do you think these influential women throughout history would make of where we are today? And what did you learn from these women that you studied that can be carried on into the future?
That is a great question. I think they would be quite frustrated with,
agreed.
with the situation of women today. But I also think that Frances Willard was a temperance reformer, extremely active and nationally well-known in the 1890s across the country. She always talked about progress as a spiral, that as we move forward, it's certainly not a straight line. And that has really been something I've been thinking quite a bit about lately, because I certainly see that is the case today. We have come a long way from 1900, when we didn't have the right to vote and access to education and employment and the kind of many other kinds of rights that we have today as women. But certainly there is also far to go, and we have to protect our rights and really move forward. And also, I think, really be more inclusive. So I find the stories that I tell about some of these women in the past to be inspiring and also challenging. And I think that if they were to look at us today, they would, I believe, encourage us to keep moving and to see that progress is taking place, although certainly not in a straight line.
Yeah, I would just add to that. Thank you, Joan. That I have exactly the same point to say, that we've made a lot of progress, obviously. But if we can be more inclusive going forward, we could maybe make progress faster, because mm-hmm. we'll have a wider band of efforts, and that could move the advancement of women forward faster. And that's what the Women's Fund is really focused on, is to create an inclusive community where we can really wrestle and talk through issues and projects that are affecting the impact of and having an impact on women, so that we can bring everyone to the table. We can have a broader band of people working to advance equity for women.
Joan Marie Johnson is a historian and the author of Funding Feminism, Moneyed Women, Philanthropy, and the Women's Movement. Lisa Antonito is the executive director of the Women's Fund of Greater Milwaukee, and they spoke with Audrey Nowakowski.
Johnson speaks at the fund's annual education event about the power of philanthropy, November 1st. We'll have an interview with one of the philanthropists being honored at the event on tomorrow's show.